It's 5:06 and you're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. ABC News anchor Dan Harris has been on assignments that range from presidential elections to human trafficking. He's even had a run-in with wild elephants.
But, says Harris, his most challenging assignment by far was much more personal, finding a way to tame the voice inside his head.
Dan Harris joins us today to tell the intimate story of his journey to not only tame that voice, but find greater happiness and peace of mind.
His journey took him from the bright lights of TV studios to the fringes of self-help and the front line of neuroscience to come away with a simple way to calm his mind and be at least 10% happier every day.
Dan Harris's new book is 10% Happier, How I Tamed the Voice in My Head, Reduced Stress Without Losing My Edge, and Found Self-Help That Actually Works. He's with us today to share what he learned. Dan, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me on. I appreciate it.
Let's jump in with that voice in your head. The original title of your book, I can't say on the air, but it was, I'll paraphrase, my inner voice is a jerk. What was your inner voice and what kind of things was it telling you, that inner narrative?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's kind of a universal thing. We all have an inner narrator that is really the central feature of our lives. It is what we take to be us, the self. And most of us are so entranced by the nonstop conversation we're having with ourselves that we're unaware of this inner narrator. But it's the thing that has us constantly projecting into the future or remembering the past instead of being focused on whatever's happening right now. It's a sort of a jumble of urges and desires that has you reaching in the fridge when you're not hungry, or you know, checking your email when you're supposed to be talking to your kid. And having that pointed out to me was very powerful, and then finding a way to fix it was even more powerful.
We'll get into to fix it, but I want to lead you through how you got into trouble where you felt like you needed fixing. You were in a pretty high stress line of work, network journalism, not mellow like us here at Public Radio. And that inner voice was a driver. You saw it as a positive in some ways, even though it sometimes went in negative directions. Where was it steering you wrong?
Yeah, I mean, I think you're exactly right that it can be positive. It can be what drives us. It can to drive us to succeed. It can drive us to be generous or funny or insightful. But it can also, if you're unaware of it, be a tricky puppeteer. In my case, I made a series of bad decisions that sort of began with my arrival here at ABC News when I was 28 years old. And I looked like I was barely post-pubescent, and I was working with these giants like Diane Sawyer and Peter Jennings and Ted Koppel, and I was green and aware of it and insecure about it. And so I made this decision to be a workaholic, and I threw myself into it. And after 9/11, I went to war zones across the Middle East and Pakistan and Afghanistan and Iraq, et cetera, et cetera. And I kind of did so without really thinking about the psychological ramifications. And when I came home from that, after doing that for several years, I got depressed, crashed and burned a little bit, and then did another really dumb thing, which was I self-medicated for a brief period of time with recreational drugs. And even though I wasn't doing that when I was at work, definitely not when I was on the air, I later learned from my doctor that it raises the level of adrenaline in the brain, which is most likely what led to my having a panic attack on national television.
That's the nightmare for a person, journalism. You're on the air nationally and you have a panic attack.
Exactly. I mean, I was anchoring on Good Morning America, and I was halfway through a brief news update, and I just lost the ability to breathe. I couldn't breathe. My heart was racing. I just couldn't think straight anymore, and I had to bail right in the middle, and it was the most embarrassing thing that's ever happened to me.
So now you're thinking, I got to help myself, but then there's this self-help movement. You felt, I'm going to understate it here, a bit skeptical about the self-help movement.
Yeah, I still think self-help is largely ridiculous. And the idea that you can solve all of your problems through the power of positive thinking is, I believe, demonstratively baloney. And but I found myself gravitating towards some of the more interesting parts of self-help, like this guy Eckhart Tolle, who was the first person I had ever heard talk about the voice in the head. And so there were some parts of self-help that I thought was interesting, but also a lot of it was really off-putting. And ultimately, after sort of marinating in this strange little American subculture for a while, I got turned on to the last thing I ever thought would be useful, which is meditation.
And what did you think of meditation before you gave it a shot?
as you can tell, I'm a pretty skeptical guy. I thought meditation was uniquely ridiculous for you know, hippies and gurus and people who live in a yurt or, you know, collect crystals or just not me, basically, you know, fans of Enya and John Tesh. And I was not going to go there. But then I heard about the science, and the science is incredible.
Bonus points for use of yurt there. What is it that got you making the first step and saying, okay, I'm going to swallow the skepticism for a little bit and actually try meditating?
It was when I was confronted with this is a sheer volume of science that says that that meditation is it can do pretty incredible things for your brain and your body. You know, it's been shown to reduce your blood pressure, boost your immune system, and a whole range of positive effects on ailments, and both physical and psychological. But the real amazing stuff is the brain science, which a lot of which is being done in Madison, Wisconsin.
Yeah.
By Dr. Richie Davidson, who's a friend of mine, and it's been shown to thicken the gray matter, literally make your gray matter thicker in areas associated with self-awareness and compassion, and reduce the gray matter in an area associated with stress. And so this is why it's now being done by a whole elite subculture of very successful and impressive people, from the U.S. Marines to the U.S. Army to corporate executives to doctors, lawyers, school children, and even fidgety, skeptical news anchors.
Well, the only time I've ever meditated was with Richie Davidson sitting in the chair next to me teaching us how to meditate on the air. I had one of the same reservations that you expressed before you tried it, that you're not the kind of person, that I'm not the kind of person who could sit still and do nothing for a period of time.
But the thing is, first of all, sitting still is it's tricky still for me to this day, and I've been doing it for a long time. But you're not doing nothing, as a matter of fact. It's rigorous brain exercise, trying to wrestle the mind to the ground. It's like holding a live fish in your hands. It's really hard. But so is exercise. If you go to the gym and you're on the treadmill and you're doing it right, it's going to be difficult. That's the same thing with meditation. You got to think about it just like exercise for your brain. Every time, basically a focusing exercise. And every time you lose your focus and then return back to your point of focus, it's like doing a bicep curl for your brain. And you're breaking a lifetime of habit of walking around in a fog of memory or fantasy and actually focusing on what's happening right now. And it's beneficial in a whole bunch of ways.
Well, getting back to taming that voice in your head, that inner narrative we were talking about earlier, how did studying meditation, and I guess more to the point, practicing meditation, help you rein in that inner voice?
The first thing is the learning to focus when you're, to use a lack of a cliche, a less cliched term, when you're in the moment, when you're paying attention to what's happening right now, the inner narrator is in a lot less control. You're not casting off into some imagined future or remembering some idealized past. You're actually right here, right now. And so you're not getting yanked around as much. And so the ability, the muscle, building up the muscle to just pay attention is a huge way to defang the voice in the head. But really, the superpower that comes over time is the ability to see what's going on in your mind at any given moment, to notice anger, for example, without getting carried away by it. So let me just give you a quick example. You're online at Starbucks. Somebody cuts you off. You think to yourself, I'm angry. You then reflexively, immediately, and automatically inhabit the thought. You actually become angry. With mindfulness, with meditation, you actually learn to see the anger coming up in your head, or maybe the buzzing in your chest, your ears getting red, and you notice what's happening, but you don't actually have to take the bait and get carried away by it. That's amazing. I mean, to think about how many times we lose our temper and regret it later. Think of any high-stress meetings we're in where it would have been nice to be the calmest person in the room. Think about how many times we eat when we're not actually hungry. If you can short-circuit this habitual behavior, it's a huge, huge advantage.
How long did it take to develop that? Was it overnight? You started meditating. All of a sudden, you had that meta ability to notice that you're angry and deal with it?
It took me a while, and I'm not perfect. I mean, there's a reason why I call the book 10% Happier. Mm-hmm. If we had my wife on the line right now, she could give you an hour-long interview on the ways in which I am imperfect. So I am not claiming that I became the Dalai Lama overnight. However, change did happen very quickly, and I would tell your listeners, give it 5 minutes a day for a couple of weeks, and if you don't find yourself feeling calmer, better at being present and focused on whatever is happening at any given moment and a little bit more aware of what's actually happening in your skull, send me a note on Twitter and tell me I'm an idiot. But I don't think you'll be sending that note, because I actually think 5 minutes a day will make a significant difference.
We're talking with Dan Harris, co-anchor at ABC News, co-anchor for the weekend edition of Good Morning America. He's the author of the new book, 10% Happier. And you can join in. Have you tried meditation, or are you skeptical of it? If you've tried it, has it made a difference in your life? If you have a question, what would you hope to get out of it? Do you need a pep talk to give it a shot? Call up at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email talk@wpr.org. We're talking with Dan Harris, co-anchor of ABC News' Nightline and co-anchor for the weekend edition of Good Morning America. His new book is 10% Happier, about how he dealt with stress and a panic attack on the air, ultimately by turning to meditation. He found himself, give or take, about 10% happier. Dan, I want to talk about that 10% thing. As you mentioned earlier, you were and still are skeptical of self-help because of a lot of over-promising. Why is that the case? Why is there so much of that out there?
It sells books, and people like the idea of a miracle cure. It's attractive. But I think we're ready in America for a more realistic discussion. I think people have been burned enough times being sold a bill of goods that they can fix everything in their life in one fell swoop. And for me, the answer, 10% happier, that I started saying that when my skeptical friends would ask me, why are you meditating? What's happened to you? And I found myself saying, oh, you know, because it makes me 10% happier. And I would notice when I said that, that the looks of scorn on the faces of my friends would transform into something more like interest and envy, because, you know, 10% is a pretty good return on investment, and it sounds reasonable. So I just named the book that.
We'll go to our callers now at 800-642-1234. We've got Guy on the line in West Allis. Guy, you're on the air.
Hi. I'm wondering, when do you find is the best time to meditate? Because I know right now I'm potentially going through a job layoff, and it's like I'm stressed a lot of the time, and it's like, you know, do I do it right away in the morning? Would that help all day? Or do I have to try to find time at work where I can get away from everybody and do it there, but then you're supposed to be at work, and it's like, when's the best time to do it?
I don't think first of all, thanks for the question. I appreciate it. I don't think you have to be overly neurotic or militant about it. I think you should do it whenever is best for you. Personally, my schedule is crazy, so I just fit it in when I can. You don't want to make it something that's just another stressor in your life. It should be fit in a time when you can, but every day is different. And so I try to do 30 minutes a day. That's just because I find it really beneficial. But there are days when things are super crazy, like they were yesterday, for example, and I only did 10. So give yourself a break, but there's something about the dailiness of it that can make a huge difference, because it's that daily confrontation with the craziness of your own mind that allows you, when your mind is being crazy in real life, to recognize, oh, I don't have to take this so seriously.
But don't stress out because you can't find that full half hour to fit in.
Correct. Okay. And by the way, I do a half hour, but I'm writing a book about this. So, I mean, I'm not necessarily saying everybody needs to do a half hour. I believe that 5 minutes is enough, especially for a starter.
Guy, thanks for the question and good luck with your job situation.
Yeah.
We'll go now to Kurt in Evansville. Kurt, hi.
Hi. I'm listening to this and I'm wondering, is there much of a difference between prayer and meditation? And if there is, what would that difference be?
You know, it depends on the prayer and it depends on the meditation, and from a neurological standpoint. So there have been studies that look at what prayer does to the brain, as well as all these studies about what meditation does to the brain. And I'm not an expert on the prayer piece of this, but I believe there's some commonalities. And I have some evangelical friends who, for example, a pastor friend of mine who does this practice where he walks around and tries to see the world through Jesus's eyes, and so in a much more compassionate way, and just in his view of passersby on the street. That's not entirely dissimilar to a type of meditation known as compassion meditation. What I think is radical about both of these is that you're actually training your brain to be more empathetic and more compassionate. It shows up on the brain scans when you do compassion meditation. What a radical notion that we aren't stuck with our perceived level of compassion from birth. It's actually a muscle we can train. Think about if we start teaching kids how to do this, what that would do for bullying, or never mind the future of the planet. So and meditation is the same thing. It basically is saying you're not stuck with your level of happiness just based on the quality of your childhood or your employment situation or whether you've won the lottery recently. It's a skill that can be trained. To me, that is such a radical and interesting notion.
And not just happiness. I think you make the point in there that we don't have to take any of our basic personality traits or maybe flaws for granted.
It's all part of a story we tell ourselves. We are this kind of person. I'm a shy person, or I'm a loner, or I'm irritable, et cetera, as if these are fixed things that can never, ever be changed. But I think they can be changed. I'm not talking about some radical overnight transformation into, a golden retriever. I'm just saying that around the edges, you can recognize that this is a story you're telling yourself that in any given moment isn't necessarily true. And with meditation, you can get much better at not taking these habitual, lifelong, and often debilitating stories so seriously.
Back to our callers now with Dawn in Waukesha. Dawn, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What do you think about this?
Well, my question is, I was telling the person who answered the phone, type AAA you're talking to right now, going from 5 in the morning till 10 or 11 at night. How do you slow down? How do you actually meditate? I mean, I'm an educated person, but how do you meditate? What do you mean when you say meditate? You sit there on a pillow? What do you do?
You want me to give you a quick 30-second lesson?
101. Go for it, Dan. Yeah.
All right, let's do this. The other day, for a New York Times technology reporter, I gave him a meditation lesson in fewer characters than it takes to send a tweet. But I'm going to give you a slightly longer version, Don. With the caveat that the word meditation is kind of like the word sports. It can describe a whole range of activities, but I'm talking about a meditation called mindfulness, which is completely secular, nothing to join, no fees to pay, nothing to believe or anything like that. It's just a form of exercise for your brain. So here's what it involves. Sit down. You can actually do it standing up or lying down, but traditionally you just sit down. You don't have to be cross-legged. You can be in a chair. It's important to have your spine straight, just because you don't want to fall asleep if you're too slouched. Close your eyes and then pick a spot where you feel your breath most prominently, like your nose, your chest, your belly. And you don't have to breathe in any special way. Just notice what it feels like when the breath comes in and when the breath goes out. There's nothing special about the breath. It's just a good thing to focus on because we're always breathing as long as we're alive. And then every time your mind wanders, which it will a million times, whether you're AAA personality or not, your mind is going to wander to crazy things like, what did I have for lunch? Why did I say that stupid thing to my boss, et cetera, et cetera. Every time your mind wanders, just forgive yourself and bring your attention back to your breath. And it's rigorous. It's a rigorous brain exercise. It's very tough to do. But every time you catch yourself, that's a bicep curl for your brain. You are breaking a lifetime of habit of just being lost in this thought that defines our life. Instead, you're just focusing on what's happening right now, which in this case is your breath.
Don, give it a shot and good luck. Dan, one thing you were worried about is maybe if you solve some of the problems with the voice in your head, you might lose your edge and you're in an industry where maybe it's taken for granted. You're going to be hot-tempered, high stress, and that's just part of the gig.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is a widespread cultural assumption that in order to be successful, you have to be somewhat miserable. In order to be Van Gogh, you need to cut your ear off. But I'm not sure that's true. In fact, I found that the less the not being a hostage to the noise in my brain, the noise that we all have going on in our mind at any given moment, has made me a better, more efficient, effective decision maker, a better colleague, a better listener, more efficient at doing the work I need to do at any given moment. And this is why you're seeing such spectacularly successful people like the co-founder of Twitter, Phil Jackson, the basketball coach, the U.S. Marines, the U.S. Army, rock stars, et cetera, now adopting this practice because it is you can see the increased, the decreased mental noise and the increased efficiency.
Dan, thanks a lot for joining us.
Oh, it's a total pleasure. Thanks for having me.
That's Dan Harris, co-anchor of ABC News' Nightline and co-anchor for the weekend edition of Good Morning America. His new book is 10% Happier. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, our guest says Sheryl Sandberg's call to women to lean in is the wrong way to go. We'll find out why.
But first, it's Sunshine Week, a national initiative to make the case for more open and transparent government.
Here in Wisconsin, state law authorizes the attorney general and local district attorneys to use court action to enforce open government laws. But according to our next guest, Attorney General J.V. Van Hollen has never pursued such court action during his time in office.
Eric Litke is a reporter with the Gannett, Wisconsin investigative team. He's produced a two-part series that examines the shortcomings of Wisconsin laws on government public records and open meetings. Eric, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Well, first, is this just a journalist problem, or should the public in general be worried about open meetings and open records laws?
Absolutely. I mean, the short answer is that open government is better government. Public officials, whether elected or appointed, are more likely to make decisions that are in the best interest of the citizens if they know citizens are paying attention. Open records are a key way that citizens and journalists alike can kind of look behind the curtain. See whether government is operating efficiently, ethically, and in the best interest of the people who are paying for it. Open meetings laws are kind of in the same vein. They're supposed to make sure that discussions and decisions by public officials are happening out in public. The question that we addressed in our series is basically whether these public records and open meetings laws are being properly enforced. Open government laws are all well and good, but their value drops dramatically. There's no repercussions for ignoring the law.
And what you've tracked in your series in large part is a lack of citations issued for violations of open government laws. What kind of violations are out there that you're referring to?
Sure. We basically went through online court records over the last 5 years and looked for any citations that were issued for violations of open meetings or public records law. We found a total of 7 citations. 17 others were filed but later dismissed. So over a 5-year span across 72 counties, 7 different citations for violating open meetings laws, none for violating public records laws. And we talked to prosecutors, and some say, well, that's because either the laws are generally being followed or because they're using these situations, these violations, as kind of a teachable moment to say, well, here's what you should have done and here's how to do it next time, as opposed to issuing a citation. But the other way to look at that is that some of these complaints are falling on deaf ears. We talked to a couple folks, a lady in Sheboygan County and a woman in Appleton, who had taken complaints to a local district attorney saying, here's what I think is a violation of open meetings law or public records law. What can you do about it? And they were essentially ignored, had to go file court action on their own, spend thousands of dollars and more than a year in court. And in both cases, they were ultimately successful in establishing that the law was being violated.
Well, from the Attorney General's perspective, could it be just a matter of priorities? They've got bigger things, more pressing things on their plate, and something has to fall by the wayside?
Well, state law basically provides 2 different enforcement options here. District attorneys in each county can pursue these, or the Attorney General can't. J.B. Van Hollen, throughout his time in office, has just made it a matter of policy to say he's going to defer to local district attorneys. Peg Lautenschlager had taken action a couple times to enforce open government laws, but Van Hollen, who was not willing to talk to me on this particularly, but his office has sent out letters to the hundreds of folks that have questions on open meetings or open government, and they consistently say that it's a matter of policy and resources for the AG's office. So basically, yeah, they're saying that their priorities and their manpower needs to be headed elsewhere. DAs will say the same thing. You know, when we asked a few, you know, how some of these may have fallen through the cracks, basically, you know, when you put an open government complaint up against a serious felony case, they're saying they're short-staffed and they've got to make decisions as to what they pursue.
And these aren't cases that come up all the time. A DA's office in a county might or a city might be ready to deal with that felony you mentioned. Are they trained? Are they familiar with how to approach an open records or open meeting violation?
It certainly seems like that's something that varies a lot by county. One of the better setups among the folks that I talked to was out of Winnebago County. They have a particular prosecutor that is tasked with dealing with these, and he's gone through some specialized training on open records and open meetings law, and they also have a part-time investigator who has some special training on this. Other DAs that I talked to acknowledge that it's not an area of the law that they're real familiar with. They may, in many cases, get one or two complaints a year at most on things like this. And when those do come up, there'd be a lot of research that has to take place to say, okay, well, what does the law actually say? Is this a violation? How do you go about enforcing it? Because they're very nuanced laws.
So if I'm a citizen, I'm trying to raise one of these complaints, I'm not getting any help from my local DA or from the Attorney General's office, maybe I don't have the money to pursue things with private lawsuits, do I have any recourse at that point?
If you don't have the money or the desire to pursue it in court yourself, you're pretty much in a tough spot. There certainly is a way to pursue that in court on your own. For a public records request denied, you can seek a writ of mandamus that would have a judge order that certain records be released. That's something that could theoretically be done on your own, but typically, this is something where it's a matter of getting attorneys involved. There is recourse at the end of it. The lady we profiled out of Sheboygan County, as part of a settlement agreement, was able to get all of her attorney fees refunded. Lady out of Appleton is still seeking that in court, but state statute does allow that a citizen who's fighting an open government complaint and succeeds can recover the attorney costs. But it is still a matter of fronting that money and hoping to succeed and maybe be able to recover it in the end. But as we have these situations come up, it's putting a lot of responsibility on the citizen to do the enforcement of the law as opposed to having that be in the hands of the attorney general or of a district attorney.
In reporting on this story, did you get the sense that local governments were and local government bodies were aware of the open records and open meetings requirements and were just flouting them, knowing nothing bad would happen? Or are they just not quite sure how to comply? They don't know that they need to make this meeting open and that meeting not open.
I think the entities that are blatantly trying to hide something from the public are going to certainly be the exception. It's more frequently going to be something that occurs maybe in a smaller township where you have someone who's been elected to office who's not real familiar with how government works. Maybe it's their first term in office. And if there's no mechanism to have gotten them training on what's required to post an agenda that has, adequately descriptive agenda items, what's required if someone files a records request, what should be released, what shouldn't. Those are the types of violations that can come up. And so that's the explanation that prosecutors give in saying that, these may be more teachable moments than something where you want to file a citation. The concern potentially comes up, if it's a situation where the DA is not going to get involved at all.
You mentioned those teachable moments, and this is Sunshine Week, maybe another teachable moment. Are local governments starting to get the message about open government?
That's a difficult thing to say. Some of the folks I talked to basically say, you never really know the scope of these types of issues because in many cases there's just not enough people that are paying attention, particularly when you get into a smaller municipality. There may be only a handful of people, if any, that are attending a village board meeting or something like that, and they wouldn't necessarily have the training to know a violation when they see it. So it's really a difficult thing to say whether that's something that's better now than it used to be.
And before we let you go, it's Sunshine Week. If someone's listening as a citizen or somebody in a local government elected office, appointed office, where can they go to find out more about Sunshine Week and open government laws?
Sunshine Week website is sunshineweek.org. So that has some general information on kind of what this initiative is in terms of raising awareness. For those interested in Wisconsin open government and open meetings, public records in particular, J.B. Van Hollen's office has produced very extensive rundown of what state statute requires and allows in terms of what types of records are available, what it should cost to get them, how long it should take, what it means to have an open meeting. So those can be viewed on the Attorney General's website.
Eric, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
That's Eric Littke, an investigative reporter for Gannett Wisconsin Media. His two-part series looking at Wisconsin's open government laws in honor of Sunshine Week concludes today. Our next guest was a working mom with a demanding job. She took the advice that Facebook Chief Operating Officer Sheryl Sandberg gave to women and got busy leaning in. She signed up for extra work assignments, and she leaned into her role as a mom and got busy organizing parties and becoming a room mother. Then the bottom fell out.
Rosa Brooks is with us now to tell us why women should forget Sheryl Sandberg's advice about turbocharging their careers by leaning in. Brooks is a law professor at the Georgetown University Law Center and a columnist at Foreign Policy Magazine, also a fellow at the New America Foundation. Rosa, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Well, to get caught up, how would you summarize what Sheryl Sandberg's advice to women means when she urges them to lean in?
You know, I think she means two things, one of which I absolutely agree with and then one of which I'm much more ambivalent about. The piece that I think is important and good is she reminds women not to self-undermine and do the, oh, gee, I'm sure what I'm about to say is probably wrong, but I'm really sorry for interrupting and even saying it. And, you know, she urges women to not do things like that, to, you know, to have confidence in themselves and their expertise, which is something I think men traditionally have found a little easier than women. And I think that's right and that's important. I'm much more ambivalent about her advice to lean in a way that means doing more, more, more. And I think she's frankly ambivalent about that herself. But the nature of the modern workplace has been such that increasingly being a good worker is equated with being a ubiquitous worker who's around or available 24/7. And when you lean into that, it really hurts you, particularly women who usually have a second shift at home of childcare and other household responsibilities.
So when you do all of this leaning in, what is it supposed to get you as a woman, as a worker, as a mom? What is it supposed to net you?
You know, I think the idea, of course, is that we still live in a world in which men outnumber women in leadership positions in almost every aspect of our society, whether it's Fortune 500 companies, senior government and political positions, big law firm, leadership positions, you name it. And women also still earn less than men in comparable positions. And those are real problems. And to the extent that women sort of self-undermine by taking themselves out of the running or undermining their own authority, I think Sheryl Sandberg is absolutely right. But to the extent that the implied solution is to just do more and more and more and more, I think that's unworkable. It's unworkable for women. It's unworkable for men. It's bad for workplace productivity. It's bad for the quality of work. And it particularly tends to keep women from succeeding and gaining leadership positions.
So you didn't think that at first. You decided to take Sheryl Sandberg's advice out for a test spin. You work in the field of foreign policy. You're also a mom whose kids have active lives. When did you start to try to take her advice and see what happened when you leaned in?
You know, readers of the column that we're talking about, I think, will know that that was largely tongue-in-cheek. I did not, in fact, ever make a decision to suddenly lean in, as in contrast to anything I'd been doing in the past. What did happen for me and what motivated me to write that column is that, like many women, I think, I found myself at one of those moments, a moment that I'm sure is familiar to everyone, particularly women and also to some men. One of those moments where I was trying to do 16 things at once. I was actually on an Amtrak train. I was trying to write a column. I was trying to edit a memo. I was trying to email and make phone calls to set up a cast party for my daughter's sixth grade musical. I had slept 3 hours the night before. I was going to race off to a work-related dinner the minute I got to my destination, then get up at 5 in the morning to take an Amtrak train back home again. And I thought, whoa, this is nuts. I'm trying to be perfect at everything and never say no to anything, and this is just crushing me. It's bad for me. It's bad for my work. It's bad for my kids.
So it seems like it should be sort of a girl power moment when you feel like you can do it all. You can juggle those 16 things on 3 hours of sleep. But the result for you, and you're guessing for lots of other women, is that they get sort of crushed under these loads. So is that the core of what's wrong with Lean In, that it's just not sustainable?
Well, I think it doesn't really fundamentally challenge what has happened to the workplace and what has happened to our expectations of parents, and particularly women. And, you know, it's not really fair, obviously. I joke about hating Sheryl Sandberg. I don't really hate her. And it's not really fair to ask her to solve every problem. I think it's just the book has become so iconic for so many people. But I think the fundamental message people take away from it misses something really important, which is that in the last 30 to 40 years, two things have happened at the same time in American society, and together they're really pernicious, particularly for women. And those two things are that we have shifted to the assumption of 24/7 workplace availability. You know, remember, it used to be, it was once upon a time, it was a reform to create the 8-hour workday and the 40-hour work week. Today, most Americans, regardless of their income levels, if they're employed, they are working 60, 80, 100-hour work weeks, one way or the other, either because they've got to be at the office, or maybe they come home but they're turning on the BlackBerry, they're right back to the laptop, they're doing conference calls while they're making breakfast in the morning. And we've come to assume that that's what good work is working all the time. At the very same time, we've seen a real shift in our cultural understanding of what makes a parent a good parent. I'm in my 40s. When I was a child, I would come home from school and my mother would say, go out and play, come back at dinner time. And today, especially for middle and upper middle class kids, we equate good parenting with a parent who's always shepherding their child to supervised play dates, lessons, tutoring, extracurricular activities, which of course also just requires an adult to be available to supervise, to chaperone, to drive kids everywhere. And it literally is impossible for one human being to both manage the sort of modern parenting expectations and modern workplace expectations. Men, by and large, aren't expected to try to do both. Men are usually assumed to, you know, if you're a good worker and you see your kids a few times a week at dinner, you're doing a lot better than your father's generation was. But for women, both of those cultures are incredibly demanding and just unsustainable.
Do you think that's widely acknowledged, that it is unsustainable for women to do both these, essentially two full-time plus jobs? Or do you think we're still in a place where women are expected to lean in and commit just as much as men if they want to get ahead?
I think that's the trouble, and we haven't yet fully culturally acknowledged how unsustainable this is and how bad it is, not just for individuals, but for the quality of the work we do and the quality of the parenting we provide, quite frankly. You know, and I think that's the one thing I would not want anyone to take away from my column is the idea that this is just a call to lean out and do less, or opt out, or slack off. It's instead a call to challenge the assumption that more is better. Very often more is worse. Very often doing more and more and more means you're working around the clock, but the memos you write, the things that you produce, the ideas you generate are worse. They're poor quality. You're making bad decisions. You're producing bad stuff. Very often the helicopter parent who's hovering over their child is not only exhausted, stressed out, and their child will pick up on that, but they're teaching children that they can't function independently. You know, and so I think that what we really need to be doing is not so much saying, oh, take a break, take time to smell the roses. That's something that we should do that on an individual level. But there is a broader point here, which is that if we want a society that enables women to be in leadership positions, as well as a society that's just healthier for all of us, men and women and the workplace, we need to push back really hard in a really organized way, both against the intensive parenting culture and its demands and against the assumption that more is always better in the workplace.
So is that going to be a hard thing for women to achieve? Because as you said, it needs to be an organized movement. Everyone needs to do it, probably men included, if
Absolutely.
They want to get traction on this. Because if it's just a few women who are leaning back and saying, whoa, this is too much, they're just going to get passed up and the system will just keep on chugging past them.
No, it is going to be hard, no question about it, because, and it's got several different dimensions. I mean, there's a piece that we can each do as individuals. There's a piece that we can do collectively in our schools, in our communities, in our workplaces. And there's a long-term piece, which involves legislative change, you know, better, more family-friendly laws. And that's going to take a while. That's going to be a heavy lift. But I don't think that it is impossible for each of us to literally start right now. And part of it is just having the personal courage to realize that it really is okay to say at work, I've got to go home at 6. If there's an emergency, let me know. Otherwise, I'll be back at 9, and I'll take care of this work then. And I think many people often have and this is not true, obviously, for hourly wage workers who are often extremely vulnerable. But those of us in salaried positions often have much more power than we think we have, and a much greater ability than we think we have to push back gently. And I think that when I have tried to do that, when many people I know have tried to do that, usually they're quite astonished that the response is not, oh, you're a bad employee. The response is, oh, good idea. I'll go home too. I'll see you in the morning. And so part of it is just having the personal courage to set reasonable limits. But the other piece of it, and this is still, you know, short of that long-term legislative change.
And we're just about out of time. I'm sorry we don't have time for the end of your sentence, but
no worries,
Rosa,
that's okay.
Thank you so much for joining us.
Pleasure. Glad to be here.
We've been talking to Rosa Brooks, a law professor at the Georgetown University Law Center.